Hello and welcome to Russians with Attitude. Happy Valentine's Day! China has finally pulled out their Jade stock and they shoot UFOs all over US. One of the last bridges that connects Bakhmut to Ukraine was blown up. Russian offensive on Uglydar is not going as planned. US Embassy issued a statement: do not travel to Russia, depart immediately. Something sinister is in the works. But before we get to discuss all that, let's talk about love. It is Saint Valentine's Day after all. Jesus said, love your enemy. What does it mean? Can it be really applied to war and enemy troops? Let's try to have a little philosophical discussion about it as an introduction. As I was riding in my Lada car this morning, I was visited by a spirit of Taras Bulba, and it struck me, he loved his enemy. Well, at least one of them. He loved his son, Andrei, who betrayed his Cossack king, and despite loving him, Taras had to kill him for betrayal. Let me remind you what this romantic novel was about. It was written by Nikolai Gogol, one of the greatest Russian writers of the golden age of Russian literature. Gogol was from a Cossack family, and he wrote a few works about Ukraine, its mystique and history. Taras Bulba is a novel about Zaporozhian Cossack, going by the same name, and his sons, Andrei and Ostap. His sons study at the Kiev Academy, and then they return home to their father. Andrei is a romantic fella. Ostap is a more traditional Cossack bro, let's say that. So they are different. And back in Kiev, Andrei fell in love with Polish aristocratic girl. She friend-zoned him. All of it is happening in the first half of 17th century, and largely it's based on real events about the many Cossack rebellions against the Poles. But let's get to that. So the sons reunite with their father, and this old Cossack is a bit of a hawk, a bit of a warmonger. He wants to fight the Poles badly, because the Poles commit many atrocities against the Cossacks, against the Orthodox Christians in general. The Poles control entire Ukraine west of Dnieper River. And as Cossacks believe, the Poles are helped by the Jews. Taras with his sons go to a Cossack host in Zaporozhye. There they party with a large number of Cossacks, and he rouses them up to replace the current weak Cossack hetman, their leader, who is reluctant about breaking the truce with the Poles, and go to war and beat them bloody. The Cossacks party, then they do a little pogrom, and then they finally set off on a campaign against the Poles. They besiege Dubna Castle, where, surrounded by the Cossacks and short of supplies, the Poles inside the walls begin to starve. One night, a Tatar woman comes out of the castle through a secret passage. She comes up to Andrei, the romantic son of Taras Bulba. He recognizes her. She was one of the servants of the Polish girl. And the Tatar woman says, Andrei, come with me through a secret passage. Your beloved Polish girl is there, starving to death. And horrified, he goes through a secret passage and he brings the Poles food. He is so horrified that he decides to betray his brothers and flee with the Polish girl and convert to Catholicism and all that. Meanwhile, several companies of Polish soldiers march into Dubna to relieve the siege and destroy a regiment of Cossacks. Taras learns about his son's betrayal from Yankel the Jew, whom he saved earlier in the story from a pogrom. And during one of the final battles, he sees Andrei riding in Polish garb, goes after him, takes him off his horse, and bitterly tells him, I gave you life, and now I will take it, and kills him right on the spot. That's enough, I won't tell you any spoilers. Go read the book and or watch a movie adaptation of 2006. It's also pretty good. So what's my point here? Taras Bulba spares a member of the out-group, that Jewish fella Yankel, because he's loyal to Taras. And he kills a member of the in-group, his son, because he betrayed them. It teaches us to not be blinded by hate or love. It's, of course, it's nowhere near the Jesus message, but it's a first step up on the ladder. Because when you are not blinded by hate, only then you can have a clear picture of what's going on and make correct decisions. The only way to understand your enemy is to love them, even a tiny bit. I'm not sure that Taras loved the Poles, though. What do you think about that? Maybe I destroyed my argument here. What do you think?
Yes, I would say that Taras did not love the Poles, and especially
But he loved his son, who became...
He loved his son, yes, but his behavior, especially after both of his sons died, he was very harsh on the Poles, to say the least. And he especially hated Polish women for stealing his son, basically. I think here what's important is the distinction between personal enemies and friends and abstract enemies and friends. Because Yankel may well have been an abstract enemy for Taras, being a Jew, but he was a personal friend because years ago, before the events of the story, Yankel had helped Taras get his brother out of... he was a prisoner of war, he was taken prisoner by the Polish, and Yankel helped Taras get him out. So he had a sense of obligation towards him. It is hard to understand for many, many modern people, this sense of obligation that is omnipresent in anarchocultures. There aren't many proper anarchocultures left in the world, and it is a different way of viewing the world.
Yeah, I see that. But what's my problem with hating the abstract enemy also is that if you go overboard with the hate, you stop understanding your enemy. You start believing in fantasies, in myths,
yes,
like Ukrainians
yes.
do. Ukrainians believe, some of them, that Russians do not have toilets. It's not a correct picture of the world. What I'm saying.
Yes, that is, you're absolutely right about that. You shouldn't get too emotional about this stuff because it really clouds your judgment.
Yeah.
Because the enemy is abstract, the hatred should also be abstract and not too personalized. I mean, of course, that's easy to say when you're not in the trenches.
Of course, in the trenches, it's quite personal. It's not an abstract foe. I think, yeah, the problem of war in an emotional sphere lies not in the trenches, but the civilians going mad and foaming at the mouth. This hatred travels down to generations, and then you see some three-year-old Ukrainians shouting, "Kill the Russian," and I wouldn't want us doing it also. But if the war will be long, it's inevitable. But I think, Russians are not hateful people by nature. Because even, let's take Germans. Germans killed 20 million of Russians at least. And the hate for Germans evaporated a few decades after the fact. And modern Russians, for some reason, they like Germans. They like German produce and they are neutral or, they are interested in German culture and they like Germans overall. We are not a culture of strong, generations-long hatred to our enemies.
Yes, I think that is in general. We have a very strange way of being nationalistic. I think it has also to do with the whole Russian identity. Because it is, I would use the term anti-fragile for that. In some ways, in the Russian language, for example, the term Russian is not so much a noun, it is an adjective proper. And Russians are kind of a liminal nation in that sense. And for centuries, if not a millennium at this point, they always had to deal with a bunch of other ethnicities in their state. But on the other hand, so the Russian identity is kind of, as I said, liminal. It is Russians are very cosmopolitan in a sense. But on the other hand, when pressure is applied, they immediately become very strong. It's kind of like non-Newtonian fluids that look like a fluid, but if you put your finger on it, it becomes solid. And no other ethnicity or nation can gobble Russians up. But at the same time, they assimilate easily abroad, for example. So it's full of contradictions, as everything about Russians.
And, our hero, national hero, is Alexander Nevsky, who probably spoke Mongolian or something. He literally was friends with the Mongols for years, and he worked for them until...
Even in World War II, the last Soviet train full of steel left for Germany like an hour before they started bombing Kiev. So.
Yeah, it's very interesting how we are really different from others. And when you look at some American TV, I'm just talking to our American audience who doesn't know anything but American TV and YouTube personalities here. I'm always amazed how hateful all this political discussion seems. They all rile themselves up in this hatred that they... act, they're acting out, they don't feel it, but they must do it for entertainment. And then they shout about the globalists or about the bigots or racists, literal scum, all those terms. All right, we figure out that Russians are the most loving nation on earth.
I think it's more that Russians are just like stone cold compared to other nations.
It's about emotions. It's about,
I think Russians are simply not that emotional.
The recent news, one of the greatest Russian painters, Vazovsky, Kuinji, are Ukrainians now. Is that
and
correct?
Rapin, yes. And Rapin, according to the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Right, so because they were born in modern-day Ukraine, right?
Yes, Ivazovsky was born in Crimea. I'm not sure. I think his father was in the army. Mm-hmm. And that's why he was stationed in Crimea. But, I mean, Ivazovsky was Armenian, ethnically.
Ethnically, yeah. But Russian otherwise. Yes, and they changed their surname. It was Ivazian.
Yes, and Repin was born in what is... Kharkov Oblast nowadays, and it's very funny that they declared him a Ukrainian because there is a funny excerpt in his written by him.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a diary, or I don't remember exactly what it was, memoir, something like that, where he talked about the Khakhui and how they talk funnily, and he made fun of their dialect, and he said something like, Russians, in that excerpt too.
Kharkiv and Voronezh and Belgorod and Kursk are literally the same place. There is literally difference
absolutely.
Between the people. If you live in Kharkiv, there are two castes of people, two races. The Russians who speak proper Russian and Russians who speak Ukrainized Russian, right? The Surzhik, the rural people. And in Voronezh, the modern-day Russia, it's the same thing. People sound exactly like Eastern Ukrainians. And
yes, there's also a point when people point to, like, I don't know, Chekhov talking about the Khakhui disparagingly... as proof of anti-Ukrainian oppression in the Russian Empire, while...
It was classist, right?
Yes.
Ukrainian was a class of people without education. And
in
so,
the
of
south,
course,
yes, in the southern
aristocrats
Russian.
Would hate such people because they're noisy and loud. And but not because it's an ethnicity. They did not perceive Khakhli I don't think as in some ethnicity.
Yeah, of course. There is a general point I wanted to make about the Ukrainian language too. The dialect that most people 100, 150 years ago would have recognized as Little Russian or Ukrainian is called Surzhyk. It is often in like Wikipedia or something falsely defined as a mix of Russian and Ukrainian. But that's not what it is. It has little to do with what is modern Ukrainian. It's the classical dialect of the Russian Tsars. And the region, funnily enough, where this dialect is still spoken in the most pure conservative form is rural Lugansk Oblast. So the Lugansk People's Republic. Modern literary Ukrainian was codified in the 1920s and 1930s during Kernizatsia Ukrainization.
Actually, it was codified a little bit earlier in the late Tsarist period.
Those were completely different Ukrainian languages. I mean, they did, the Soviets did invite Grushevsky back.
Yeah.
For that, yes, that is true, but it's still, it's different. But even that 1920s, 1910s, 1930s Ukrainian, it's not up to date because the Ukrainians, they changed their language all the time since 1991, up to and including the addition or removal of letters of the alphabet.
It's a bit like the criminal jargon inside the Russian world, Fenia, because it's also changing every single decade and words mean different things.
Yeah, but that's not the point I wanted to make.
Right.
My point is that there is no Ukrainian language and no one in Ukraine knows it. The highest state officials and deputies of the parliament, they do not know Ukrainian to such an extent that they make dozens of mistakes in a 15-minute speech. And although arguably those aren't even mistakes, it's just improv on the theme of a South Russian dialect, like each according to his own understanding. Their mistakes are not even standardized. Everyone has their own mistakes. And even the same person makes different mistakes in different cases. In addition, half of the words where technically, officially, there exists a Ukrainian word are randomly substituted with Russian words. And often, when they improvise, they change the Russian words a little bit to make them sound more Ukrainian, despite their officially in the dictionary being a completely different Ukrainian word for that. The rules of the Ukrainian language are constantly changing. There is a big difference between written and spoken language, and no one except for like 10 or 20 university professors has at any given point complete mastery of up-to-date correct Ukrainian. And the point I wanted to make is that as such, the language itself is an instrument of political oppression. That is, not only does the Russian person in Ukraine have no right to use his own language in official speech and communication, he does not have the right to learn Ukrainian. He can't know Ukrainian. He has no right to speak Ukrainian. It is impossible to learn this language. Because even if you have two professors of Ukrainian philology testing someone for his knowledge of Ukrainian, they will speak different Ukrainian languages. Because one of the professors will be from a Galician village and the other from a suburb of Poltava. Thus, Zelensky, who spent the first 40 years of his life having zero interest in the Ukrainian language, he can just learn a few phrases and expressions and be lauded as a native Ukrainian speaker, whereas some guy from a village in the Lugansk People's Republic speaks in a way that 500 years of Little Russians would immediately recognize as Khokhol dialect, but he'll fail an exam on the Ukrainian language because they're not interested in him. If the person has some clout, he will be considered a Ukrainian. I was talking about this to a friend the other day, and I remembered an episode from years ago when Turchinov, the wannabe dictator of Ukraine, was presenting one of his shitty books, and the journalist asked him why that book is not written in Ukrainian, but in Russian. And Turchinov answered basically that he is not yet good enough at Ukrainian to write in it. Like, he can't write in Ukrainian, but he's trying to do it. But he's an important person, so it's okay. While if you're like a rando from Lugansk who wants to get a government job. You will go to the job interview and the bureaucrat will yell at you, why are you not speaking the national mova, чому не мовою? And this sentence will be the only phrase that bureaucrat even knows how to say in Ukrainian. Thus, this is how
It's class-based. Yes. It was class-based and it's
this
still...
language game, they just turn into very general arbitrariness, general rudeness.
Is it different from Norwegian, New Norsk, Higher Norwegian, and Bokmål?
Yes, it's different because that's just difference between how they speak and how they write.
There are cases of many languages in the country, but I think Ukraine is pretty unique in that because it doesn't seem like anything else. Even like take Belgium and. There are people who speak native language. They do not have to learn them in the adult age.
Yeah, it is completely bizarre to me when like a 40-year-old Ukrainian says, hey, I'm now learning my native language. Like, dude, if you have to learn it, it's not your native language. It's like how after the war began, the Ukrainians were happily posting statistics from Duolingo, how everyone is learning Ukrainian right now. And
yeah, it was the most popular language. And
yes, but it was it was people in Ukraine starting to learn Ukrainian.
Yeah, and it's pretty similar in Belarus. There are many languages, many Belarusian languages. Trasyanka.
I think Belarus was on the same trajectory as Ukraine, but that problem is probably solved for the foreseeable future. They don't have the motivation to go separatist anymore because Lukashenko's strategy was always to sit on two chairs, to basically whenever he wanted money from Russia, he would do something, I don't know, say something in Belarusian and say something separatisty. And whenever he wants money from the West, he would say something about Russian-Belarusian brotherhood. So it was just a way to extract money by from either the West or from Russia. And now he does not have the ability to cozy up to the West anymore.
He doesn't. But when Lukashenko dies, and there is a Belarusian government in exile in Poland, of course it's not functional. Of course it didn't ever exist. It's comprised of weird people like what's her face? Tikhanovskaya, yes, a wife of a opposition businessman who is clueless about everything. But there are a lot of people who would like to replace Lukashenko and basically repeat the Ukrainian scenario.
Yes, well,
and there is a language also prepared for it.
As of now, it's spoken even less than Ukrainian in Ukraine. They teach it at the schools that it's not optimal, but like even like 5 or 10 years ago, it was spoken by maybe like 1% of the population. It is becoming more common among young people nowadays, but I'm pretty optimistic about the trajectory of Belarusia. The whole thing seems to be taken under, it's being taken seriously in Moscow.
Belarus has a very entertaining journalist, Grigory Azarionok. Have you seen that one?
I vaguely remember the name, but I don't associate anything with it.
Yeah, but he's like a Belarusian Alex Jones because he also riles himself up. Actually, in Russia, I have not ever seen such an animated person in his hate towards the liberals, Ukrainians, and of course, Zmagary, the Belarusian nationalist.